The verses you have in front of you, Romans 1:21, Deote nontes, a kind of knowing from experience. God has provided, Paul is declaring, enough as evidence of his simple existence. And supreme nature in creation for all to be without excuse. Now, I want you to understand, Paul is not entering into an apologetic frame. He's not interested in a discussion or an argument. He was the greatest enemy of the church. Carrying papers to imprison Christians who would show up at synagogues in Damascus, through torture, forcing Christians attempting to deny their faith. And when I was struggling with my faith in university, I remember I didn't much like Paul in those days. I envied him, because if God had done to me what he did to Paul, knocked me off the horse and blinded me, and spoke out of the heavens and sent me to a guy that never ever saw me before and I never had seen him, and he would tell me the history of myself and lay hands on me and heal my blind eyes, I think I'd believe. I'd make a quick believer out of you. I found comfort in Thomas, who, even though Jesus said, more blessed to believe without seeing, which is axiomatic, you don't have the problems with your head, he still offered to submit to the very tests that Thomas asked for. He said, behold my hands and my side. Paul had a unique experience. He didn't have to apologize for the reality of God. He had confronted him one-on-one. And he declared early in this chapter, using a word that was widespread in its meaning in Rome, euangelion, which was always an announcement of good news. If they had newspapers, it would be headlined, good news from the emperor, who in ancient Rome was worshipped as God. He comes striding into the center of power in the then known world. And he comes with euangelion, translated gospel, good news from God himself. A word higher than the emperor. And he is coming proclaiming. And what is to follow in these verses that so many people had preached over the years love to camp out on. I remember one fat preacher that came to my dad's church when I was a kid. You could see the thrill bumps on his face and arms as he would bring a dictionary to the pulpit and spend night after night defining all those luscious words that begin about two verses from where I am in Romans, the list of sins down to the 32nd verse. Man, did he get off on describing these sins. And beating on people. To drive them into throes of guilt over doing such things. What I want you to understand, Paul is proclaiming, he's talking about effect rather than cause. Most preachers on these verses are talking about, if you do these things, God's going to do this to you. No, you do these things because God has already done thus to you. You understand? The verse that preceded, after unveiling the gospel, the only way out of this hopeless world where God in His wondering grace absorbed our sins and opens a doorway to eternal life based on something we can do, trust. And I ask again what I've neglected asking for many weeks. What do you want from your loved ones? You want perfection or trust? And you're as close in your heart as you'll get to God in your initial steps toward Him when you understand that's part of God's image in you. The answer is self-evident. You want trust. So does God. What Adam and Eve denied Him as they believed the devil instead of believing Him. And from then until now, He's searching for people that will trust Him. He took care of everything else. But He gives us the everything else when we trust Him, from faith to faith. And to those that do not, that want to set themselves up as Adam and Eve did, as God, not only is God's goodness revealed from heaven in the gospel, His wrath, He festered, orgy is the word, apokaluptetai, orgy, out from God, from heaven, ekurenu, out of heaven, the wrath of God, is presently being revealed against all ungodliness, which is just simply a lack of awareness and recognition and worshipful attitude in the reality of His presence. An unrighteousness which we all suffer apart from the gift of His righteousness that He gives for faith, so apart thus from faith, the only way to be righteous. And that wrath, as we will see three times in this chapter, in the verses that follow, God turns you over. The Greek has it not just turning loose of you like dropping something, but literally pushing you into the arms or clutches of something else that He who wanted to deliver you, and if you'd trust Him, He would, He turns you loose. And the section we're in now is very clearly articulated in these verses that you have in front of you. So bear with me while I pull the meaning out of these words and then preach the message. Because what is being said, D-O-T, because, you got it in front of you?
Yes,
known taste, having known, He's already argued, not argued, He just simply proclaimed it. God fed up. He's got a slow burn. Unveiled is His wrath, not fire-breathing wrath, but orgy. Thumas is breathing out storms. Orgy is a slow build-up from Adam and Eve until the moment of the gospel's unveiling. This slow wrath build-up from heaven against epi, possum, all us of being have already defined it, ungodliness, failure to recognize His presence, and worshipful awe, and unrighteousness among men. That wrath has built up, and now Paul is saying, because what is knowable about God, His footprints in the creation, having known the God, ton theon, uk hos theon, not as God, a doxison, they worshipped Him. They didn't fall down in awe. They didn't look at this wondrous creation and breathe out respect and wonder for the creator of such a handiwork, nor were they thankful. Thankful that in the vastness of the universe, and the vastness when we turn our view around to the microscopic of the sub-universe, they can't say as the psalmist did, "What is man that thou art mindful of him? But how great thou art that you had emptied the vault of heaven." They don't even know that gospel yet in the context of these verses. But here we stand hurling through space, unwilling to credit a creator. Well, does the universe require that belief? No. We quoted the last several Sundays, Carl Sagan, the great cosmologist. He says the cosmos is all that is, all that ever was, all that ever will be. There's no requirement that God's handiwork, assuming He exists, cause you, upon experiencing it, living, breathing, walking around. Most of us don't even think about simple little things. I don't know how many of you know, how many of those who listen to me, why you can stand upright. Not just because of the fact of gravity. You got little balls in your ears. They're affected by gravity. And when you change your position, the little balls hit hairs in your ear. And this encounter starts a process in your nerves that telegraphs to the brain and then to the nerves where down is. Now, all of a sudden, it makes sense why a big gob of wax can make me stagger around. Or you. I mean, these very small, delicate hairs with their nerve ends can't move too freely through a big ball of wax. So we figure out, you go to a doctor and he pulls out something that you have to turn your head. Now, I'm 72. No, I'm not. I will be. This August, I'll be 72. But, just getting started. I've never had any wax come out of my ears. But a short time back, you may recall, I had some vertigo problems. And had it continued, I would have said, "Where's the wax lifting machine?" As a start, at least. Science has contributed a lot of things. And as I'm reading from Houston Smith, I find a certain empathy with Houston Smith. Because he says, in the process of denigrating scientism, he doesn't want to be misunderstood as though he doesn't have respect for science. And then he tells how he had a PSA test, and he thought that was an airline. Until his daughter more or less told him what an old goat he was and come into the 20th century, and he had high prostate-specific antigen test in his bloodstream, threatening cancer. Well, immediately I had a sympathy with how that news must have affected him, having been down that road. And he was saying he had science to thank for prolonging more years in his life. And I can't help but say I have God to thank for prolonging mine, I'm at 0.8. And that's the wonderful news that I keep telling you. Well, let's continue with this. You see, God built all this. You want to call it a massive hide-and-seek program, a father with his children, wanting them to recognize his handiwork. If God is, he can do whatever he wants. And Paul is not arguing the pros and cons of it. He's declaring, God's fed up. In his view, he left enough evidence of his presence that at the very least, you don't have to know the redemptive plan, that's revelation knowledge. You don't even have to know about Christ, that's revelation. But the creation itself projects, points to a creator, and he's not interested in the debate between evolution and creationism. Paul is declaring, you ought to have seen it. You had among the many choices, when you look at the handiwork, recognizing there must be a craftsman. And to have crafted this deserves awe, recognition of worth, and thanksgiving. That I have my place in this beautiful creation. God declaring that. Well, now, I don't have those reactions when I look at geology and I look at biology and I look at... Okay. Then you are going to be the subject of God's wrath, which is described in the verses that follow. And Paul's not debating. He had met the risen Christ. We can find the risen Christ in the resurrection evidence, and I'll be preaching on that come Easter. But this verse says, you ought to have seen his hand in the handiwork. Because you didn't. You didn't glorify him and thank him. You became vain. Matthias is the root word, and I want to read some things about that to you. Can I bore you with this Greek again? You became Matthias. This is a condition. This is the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament. It's about 10 volumes. It isn't for vacation reading. Matthias. It denotes the world of appearance as distinct from that of being. It is a state of mind that doesn't really rest on the causes which it alleges, but is deceptive. It's self-deceptive. Only words of faith can hold in check a tormented or weary Matthias. So the word itself is instantly placed in opposition to an attitude of faith. Now, walk with me through this as I lay these words down, because it's tough to go against tradition that has all of you out there blindly doing these sins, and God's mad at you because you blindly do these sins. No. That's not what he's mad at you about. That's the easiest thing for God to take care of, is your fleshly sins. Reinhold Niebuhr and the Neo-Orthodox theologian saw this many years ago, that we start like quasi-morons saying, well, I'm not a sinner because I don't murder and steal. And then you lift it to Jesus' definition, where the thought is as bad as the deed. If you hate, you're as guilty as a murderer. And if you lust in your heart, you're as guilty as the adulterer. But even there, you're still at surface matters, yielding to the flesh, yielding to desires of the flesh. The common ground of weakness that made Jesus say when the disciples slept, when they should have been watching, the spirit's willing, the flesh is weak. Those are the easiest sins for God to take care of. He laid them on Jesus. The Spirit of God can deal with that. It's spiritual sins. It's sins of the mind and the ego and the heart that deceives. And faith is easiest found in a child. That's why Jesus said, except you become as a little child. You don't have many skeptical little children. They're open to faith, and you can so destroy them. And as the scars of life go on, we learn to be skeptical. We learn to be cynical. We learn to doubt everything. We learn, because we're in the tunnel, as I will come to reiterating again, of this materialistic world that has shut God out. Well, this state, translated vain, Matthias, is immediately in its root meaning juxtapositioned against faith. The word group often relates to a fool. Everything which resists the first commandment, which is love the Lord thy God with your whole heart in the Old Testament, everything resisting that comes under the judgment of God called Matthias, a state of mind. You become Matthias. You become anti-faith. You become anti-First Amendment, even if you don't, and I'm not amendment, anti-First Commandment, even if you don't know what it is. It has to do with attitude toward God. It has moral overtones of evil, self-deceptive pursuit of certain kinds of thoughts that continue to deceive you and others more. That's the first word. You became that in the reasonings. Dialogismos. That tells you enough. Dialogues. You ever seen some of these know-it-all people that have that evil, vain, empty brain connected to their mouth nonstop? I mean, they can motor mouth against God, ad infinitum, ad nauseam. They became this because, having known God, not as God, not glorifying or worshiping Him, nor thanking Him, they become. It's a happening. They didn't start this way. They become. Matthias, evil, anti-faith, anti-God-worshipping, anti-God-thankful, in all of their, I wish I could say it, BS. That becomes their state of being. They get on a path. They become self-deceptive and accentuate it with their mouth and their reasonings. Because instead of worshiping God and thanking Him, they become self-deceptively anti-faith, anti-God, vain is the empty, in other words, in their reasonings of them. And the verb still applies, become darkened. Eschatiste, darkened, not a natural state, but a condition of being evil in their reasoning, and a condition of being darkened. And darkness is not a condition, it is absence of light. They become empty in their self-deceived, evil reasonings, and absent light in, what's the next word? Their senseless hearts. Senseless. Asunetos. Well, let's look at that one. Asinatos. Same dictionary, volume 7 in this case, page 888. Now follow this, because it's the foundation of everything that follows in this message. Because of a failure, God's up there PO'd. He's had a slow burn. He put our father and mother in a garden. Eden means heart of God. Gave them everything on this beautiful earth created for them. Put them in charge of everything. Told them to replenish it. And they listened to Satan. And in essence, wanted God out of the garden. They had everything but the one tree which established the simple fact of his sovereignty. He had the right to say everything else but not this, because I'm still the boss. They wanted him out of the garden and they wanted all of it. Now he intruded his hand into history and had given a revelation that the church and Paul and we continuing it are spreading to a world that hasn't heard it. But to those that haven't heard it, he's angry at them. Because the obviousness of his presence is written into the creation. And yet, because he's not recognized, his wrath is now being revealed, resulting in those who did not recognize him and thank him being put in this condition to where they are self-deceived in anti-faith, anti-God thinking, and it's accentuated, I repeat, with the dialogues and reasonings that's the fruit of a senseless heart. Colloquially speaking, out of the innermost being, that which drives all of their being is made senseless. And what does that word senseless mean? In other words, this is a wrath from God out of heaven that you don't wait till the fires of hell are burning on the sole of your feet. This is a right now occurrence. And all these other verses to the 32nd verse are the result of this condition I'm now taking you to. Failure to worship God and recognize His presence if the only evidence you have is the creation. Failure to thank Him for you and who you are when all you have is the creation results in your senseless heart being darkened, and that senseless condition, asuniemi, the puts it in reverse, remember, and suniemi, the positive side of it, of which this condition translated senseless or lacking understanding is the result. Put an A in front of it, as this word does, asunatos. Sunatos would be sense, and asunatos is the reverse. Sunatos, sense, means primarily to bring together. It's an ability intuitively. You've heard me talk of field theory. Psychology is a method of learning. That intuitive ability to grasp and give meaning and understanding to things. That's synatos. It's the ability to bring together. Asynatos means you can't do it anymore. All your conclusions will come from self-deception, Mateus. All of your conclusions will be the result, and all of your reasonings, the result of a darkened mind that's darkened because you've been made asynatos. Are you following me? This is tough, heavy stuff. And then I'm going to illustrate it. It is a condition. A condition you don't want to be in. You may remember many times I've talked of the unpardonable sin. It's not just one act. I mean, I grew up in strict fundamentalism where they could do any kind of obscene sin in the world as long as they didn't say the words, "I curse the Holy Ghost." The unpardonable sin results in a condition. There's all kinds of those resulting conditions described in the Bible. A sin unto death, if we sin willfully, no more remission, presumptuous sins, and crediting the work of God when you know better. Because these same Pharisees had said earlier, when Jesus performed miracles, no man can do this except he be from God. Now, with an audience listening, they credited his works to Beelzebub. Deliberate evil, lying against their own previous position. All of these produce a state. You can recognize the state. No man cometh to the Father save the Spirit draw him, Jesus said. You are very gifted. Ought to be in a state of wonder that there is within you a capacity you can't explain, a hunger for God and the things of God. Not just a cerebral, well, if there's a chance of a hell, show me a pill that I can take in a hurry and somehow buy my insurance. But a genuine thirst for things of God can only happen to those that the Spirit's drawing. You can't come to God on your own. This is the ancient doctrine of prevenient grace. God must start the initiative. The Holy Spirit must draw you. Likewise, here we're talking in reverse. The state of being that can no longer bring things together, that makes your reasoning matthias evil, makes your dialogue and your reasoning incapable of coming to sense. And keep going. Am I boring you? Now the Greek thought and used the word as insightful mental faculty to bring things together and make sense of them. But when the word came into biblical literature, a difference from Greek thought is that in the Old Testament, insight or the ability to bring things together mentally is not a faculty native to man as such. That particular insight, the word being sunetos, is a gift from God. A gift that God gives to all mankind. He gives this insight, this capacity to reason correctly to man as distinct from animals. That's the Hebrew literature use of this word. It is a gift from God, part of His gracious acts, a remnant, vestigial, if you will, in the genes of Adam and Eve. Part of that which He breathed into Adam when He said, "Let us make man in our image and breathe some of Himself into him." One prays to God for it. I'm reading Volume 7, Theological Dictionary, the Old Testament. One prays to God for this capacity. Psalm 119. Primarily, it is proper to Him. He can withdraw it. Isaiah 29. Dominant here, as throughout Old Testament thought, is practical judgment, drawing right conclusions rather than a theoretical understanding. Though insight is a gift, one has to seek it. You go into the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Qumran community that was around when the New Testament used these words similarly. As in the Old Testament, understanding is not native to man. All insight comes from the God of perceptions. He can enlighten hearts. He can also conceal and withdraw the capacity to understand. You remember the parable that Jesus said, if you don't understand it, you can't understand any parable. Where He said He was talking in parables, lest some see and perceive, and hear and understand, and be converted. The capacity to be converted and respond to God is a gift. You abuse that gift and rule out God as an option Eliminate him from the system. God withdraws that capacity, and your reasonings thereafter, your mental thoughts are corrupted, incapable of coming to the right conclusion, because you've already ruled God out. You have failed to put him on par with the options, much less what he wants. Put him ahead of the options. He's removed from the game. His card's out of the deck. There's only the universe, the cosmos. That's all there is, that's all there was, that's all there ever will be. Goodbye, concepts of God, Marxism, opiate of the masses. The New Testament is consistent. Old Testament Jewish tradition dominates the meaning of this word. In Paul, as in the Old Testament, the organ of understanding is the heart. Quoting Romans 1:21, understanding and conduct come from this root. To be without understanding is not just a partial deficiency which might be overcome. It is total darkening, and as such, it is the work of God who can darken by withdrawing the light. You understand? Now that's what Paul is declaring happens. When confronted with God, we're not even, if you think what I'm teaching now is scary, if you're a guilty one, think of God's wrath toward those of us that neglect so great a salvation that comes from being aware of the gospel revelation, so cheapened in the modern world that Jesus in that despicable picture is seen as at your heart's door, hat in hand, begging to come in, that you might accept him. Who's the acceptor here? You might accept him. And preachers with itching ears, seeking to have them scratched with the praises of the people, peddle Christianity like carnival barkers in a smorgasbord of competing lifestyles. God said to Moses, when he said, whom shall I say sent me, to the most powerful figure, the Pharaoh of Egypt, say, I am that I am sent you. My only credential, I am. And I made it all, and I'm the boss. Now, I've been patient, but I'm fed up, God's saying. And wrath, now, to these poor people that, and I'm saying it deliberately, poor people who had only the creation to go on. Now, man, you think he's going to get at you that spit on the revelation that you've been privy to? They just have general revelation. You have special. You have knowledge of the book and the revelation of God moving on the stage of history and camping in the tent of human flesh and taking our sins and redeeming us and dying and demonstrating the one sign God promised, that he came forth from the tomb. Available to be, as with me, settled by hard study of the facts. Failure to recognize and worship and thank God for nothing more than his creation turns you over, withdraws the light, and you become senseless, evil in your thoughts, dialogues, and inability to put it together. The result is a tunnel. As we've been reading Houston Smith, a tunnel that this generation, particularly in Western worlds, are born in. You live your life in a tunnel. The base of the tunnel, scientism. The supporting sides, higher education, which matriculates down in teacher training to all public education. On the other side, the frame of reference and the support system of scientism that the law has become. And over the top, the ceiling, the media. Bacon-headed talking heads whose best credential is their dentist rather than a good teacher somewhere. How many PhDs from established universities do you even have? And if they came, most of them would have been trained under this wall of higher education. And having said that science, which I have great respect for, became a religion, scientism goes beyond science and makes the philosophic declaration that the scientific method is not only the best, I mean, if it's not the only way, it is the best avenue to truth. And any other approach to truth that cannot be based on science is inferior and to be looked down upon most of the time. And I told you how I remember in my training, I went on at Stanford to do my PhD in philosophies of education with minors in comparative religion and geography and educational psychology. But I remember at the master's level, and even at the undergraduate level, the social sciences were looked askance at in the departments and the professors and the various sections of the university. The scientists would turn their nose up that you could even tack the word science onto the word social, because that's not pure science. Scientism took over as a mindset. If science says it, that's it. And science is not theory. Science is fact. You can base your life on science. Well, I have great respect for science. And I think I know why science became such an enemy of religion. I mean, those who study science know. I mean, science originally was in the domain of philosophy. Aristotle felt you didn't have to do any experiments. By pure thought alone, you could figure the world out. And he didn't believe there was a flat earth either, but most people did. Then Ptolemy's universe came along, with the earth at the center, and everything going around it. That prevailed for 1,400 years. And the church adopted that view and put people to death who suggested anything different. Galileo knew the truth. But he had to back down when the church got on his case. And then when a pope friendly to him gave him permission to publish, and part of the problem was he was writing in Italian and the common people could read it, and it was threatening the church's position. He then was allowed to publish both positions. And eventually, science moved through the resistance of the church to the next step where the sun is the center. And then when they discovered with telescopes there were moons going around Jupiter, suddenly the church's view of the world began to crumble. And the church fought science so defensively, so erroneously, so tyrannically, that when science finally burst free, it's analogous to the French Revolution. This still makes France weak today because of its over-democratizing and its multiplicity of splinter parties, because the absolute reaction against any kind of authority that produced the French Revolution went into overkill. That's what happened. The church was wrong. The tyrannical, middle-age, anti-science view caused science, when it got free, like rebellious teenagers, to forever close the door on religion intruding into its domain. But in their overkill, they became religionists themselves and are selling a bill of goods that's plainly false. So here we go. Back to my friend Smith. Can I read from him again? How many of you bought the book? No? That's wonderful. The scientific worldview presents itself as a stupendous story. But on closer examination, it looks like three novellas strung together by sequential questions. Now, science is on stage. They dominate the worldview. To those growing up in this Western atmosphere, you have to be apologetic for believing in God. I've overtold the story of my professor, looking at my grades, pointing me as his reader, puzzling and telling me, "I don't understand, Gene. I look at your grades, I see the papers you write, I look at your whole academic record. I can't understand why you still have some supernatural view of God." And then, self-satisfied, leans back in his chair and says, I finally concluded it's some emotional vestigial tie to your father, who was a preacher in the Assemblies of God. Now, the story is more lengthy than that, but he had to write off my faith in God, because it didn't gel with my academic performance. Because thinking men in this tunnel can't believe in miracles. The universe is all that there is. It makes no allowance for a great other that can interfere with, control, and have created all of this out of nothing. So, science strings together these novellas. One, how did the universe get here? Two, how did life get here? Three, how did we human beings get here? Physics addresses the first question. Biology the second, and biology plus the cognitive sciences the third. Now let's look at physics. I might intersperse here to read that wonderful little booklet by C.S. Lewis. Man, he would have a ball writing today with the new things that have come on the scientific scene, but he said it a long time ago. If naturalism is true, the view that the physical universe and material things are all that is, every finite thing or event must be, in principle, explicable in terms of the total system. If naturalism is to be accepted, we have a right to demand that every single thing should be such that we see in general how it could be explained in terms of the total system. If any one thing exists which is of such a kind that we see in advance of it being explained that way, then naturalism's in ruins. In other words, cause and effect, everything explainable by this cosmos, because that's all that there is. One thread has been launched recently. He tries to explain it, but it's the uncertainty effect that I'll talk about in a moment, that they've discovered in the smallest particles of matter. As I tried to say a message or so ago, you cannot locate these smallest particles. You can't measure position and velocity. You can't. You can measure one or the other, but you can't measure them both. Because light's involved in the measurement of position, and you must increase the light, which narrows the wave, so you can measure from the peak of a wave to another wave, and that increases energy. And the increase in energy that hits the particle you're measuring for its position increases its speed, changes its velocity, knocks it off being what it was. So the price of measuring position is to change velocity. And light does that. So into the universe suddenly was introduced a random principle. At the lowest sub-atomic levels, the cause and effect and direct measurable relationship and definition of the elements reached is into a mystery incapable of being measured zone. And C.S. Lewis, in the early days of seeing this happening, says it so beautifully. Well then, if movements of these individual units are events on their own, then these movements are outside nature. They become part of nature only when we can cause and affect them and predict and measure. I think we can't call them supernatural, he says. That'd be too great a shock to the system. But we have to call them subnatural. But all our confidence that nature has no doors. Carl Sagan's cosmos. All that is, all that ever was, and all that ever will be. That has no doors and no reality outside herself for doors to open on. You know, there's not something else. There is no door because it's all that is. All our confidence that nature has no doors and no reality outside itself for doors to open on would have disappeared with this subnatural back door. There's apparently something outside her, the subnatural. If indeed this subnatural, and from this subnatural, that all events and all bodies, as it were, fed into her, clearly she thus has a back door opening on subnatural. Therefore, it's quite in the cards philosophically to assume maybe there's a front door where God can come in that side. Now, he would have just really had a time with this. I say on the authority of the EPR, Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen experiment, which establishes that the universe is non-local. Separated parts of it, how widely they are separated makes no difference, are simultaneously in touch with one another. In lay language, what the EPR experiment demonstrates that if you separate two interacting particles, am I boring you? Two interacting particles and give one of them a downspin, the other one will spin up. The theoretical consequences of this finding are revolutionary. So much so, Henry Stapp at the University of California called it the most important finding of science ever. For it relegates, listen, space, time, and matter to provisional status. Now, Einstein and his successors blew the concept that's so hard for us to visualize, our common sense view of things. Totally blew apart the concept that space is absolute and time is absolute. Space is not absolute. And his theory of spatial relativity is very easy to demonstrate. You're standing, or you're sitting in a train at the station, and there's a train coming the other way, and your felt sensation is you can't tell for sure whether you're moving or the other one's moving. Depends on your position. And you stand still and the train's going by. The people in the train look at you and they don't see things hurling along and breaking in the coach car. They have a sense of being pretty stable. When you stand there looking at them, they're moving. I introduce a ping pong table in the coach car. I'm inside the coach car. And you're watching, it's got bay windows the whole length of this thing. You're watching an eyedropper ping pong ball. Well, I can see. We're going 60 miles an hour, but the ball's not running away from me 6 miles an hour. The ping pong ball goes down and up. And as far as I'm concerned, hits the same spot. The point in space is right there on that table. But you're watching out there, and when the ball drops, before it hits, if we talk in milliseconds, the space has already moved. And when it goes up, let's let the train go 120 miles an hour. It's already moved. Let's move that train up to half the speed of light. Man, when I drop this, the ball lands on another planet. But my table is still hitting the same spot. So space suddenly becomes relative. It's not absolute. It's relative to where you are and who's looking and what's moving. Now add the Earth spinning and going around the sun, and the sun going around the galaxy about 170, 175 miles a second or whatever it is. And the galaxy spinning through space, space becomes suddenly pretty elastic and relative. Well, I could catch on to that one a little faster than time. Time blows my mind. Time is time. I'm going to be 72. And those that have even tried to conquer or get at, my Lord, I got stacks full of books over here. I recommend you read some of them. Recommend you read them. And you'll see an illustration of Romans 1:21, as I'm going to point out. Black holes and baby universes, Stephen Hawking. Einstein's universe, Miguel Calder. That's probably one of the better attempts, though it's dated to his anniversary. Brief history of time, from the Big Bang to black holes being Stephen Hawking's specialty. Stephen Hawking's universe. Time. Did you know that your clock runs slower right here in Los Angeles than will up on Mount Wilson? Now, the difference is so slight, you won't see it on the hands. But it's been well established and proven that time is affected by gravity. And that the further you go out, the further you go out away from gravity, did I reverse it? This time is hard for me to get. It's like this parade's in backwards. Gravity affects time. So, your clock runs slower on Mount Wilson than it does down here. You understand that? Is that right? You're the spaceman here. That's what I said the first time was right. Right?
Yes. Higher gravity, slower time.
Yes. And greater speed?
Slower time.
Slower time. So, you go way out in space, and time does what? You're the JPL man. You know the twin experiment, don't you?
Yes, sir.
You separate them in speed and time. And when they get together again, one of them is 60 years old and the other, they're both started at the same place, but one's younger than the other. One's 50 and the other's 60. And the fact they get back together again, it doesn't speed up to where they equalize. He's always younger. Now at the speed of light, there is no time. Mass and energy, and man, this is Einstein's contribution. You're going to hear it like everybody else and not understand a thing about it. I know how to say it. Energy equal mass times the constant speed of light squared. E equal mc2. And simply stated, there's a perfect balance in the universe. And somebody keeps book perfectly between energy and mass. energy increase, mass loss. A perfect balance. Mass and energy. Interchanging and equalizing. Now time, I understand that. But time. I mean, you know, get me on that spaceship. And as you approach the speed of light, mass increases. And as you get in the last few elements of approaching that constant of 186,000 miles per second, mass will reach a stage where when you hit that light barrier, mass becomes infinite, and energy becomes infinite. And no one, that's the one constant of Einstein. Everything else is relative. Speed of light is constant. And I said a few weeks ago, now isn't it interesting that some poor moron trying to accumulate from all the different myths of the time, where he's sitting down and saying, well, now this bunch says this God took his wife and cut her in five pieces and the blood flowed this direction and these parts made that and that part made that. Another one has some gross being vomiting out. All these creation myths. He sat down, my, what a genius that he decided, well, we're going to make the Hebrew story that God started by saying, let there be light. The source of everything. The energizing element of creation. And time, at that infinite point, singularity, where God can begin it all, time doesn't exist. But what blows my mind, I'm still wrestling with it, is how they took a plane and they flew around a northeastern city. I mean, delicate instruments on the plane. And they fly for enough length of time to prove that time is affected by speed. And they're carrying things up in balloons and then they put them in spaceships. The time is affected by distance from gravity. Gravity affects time. Speed affects time. It's not absolute. That's the only point. Consciously, it's hard for us. It's easier to get that space concept than it is to realize, man, I mean, I'm going to listen closely when Merle Haggard sings that song again, If I Could Only Fly. I mean, it raises all kinds of speculations to a God chaser or a God-thinking man. Because the rapture, they don't have a phrase for it in the Bible. And the rapture in the twinkling of an eye. And these people that are carrying their theories to extremes are wondering when you pass that barrier or you go past the point of ultimate expansion and start contracting. Are we going to see broken things? You're going to have an experience where broken things come up from floors and form cups. Horror the thought. I go back and reverse the process to being unborn. And my last memory will be in the contracting stage, as they speculate in science fiction. My last memory will be, what happened as my dad's sperm and my mother's egg joined and I come into being? That's my last memory. Why did I come here to hear crazy things like this? Vain, Matthias, imaginations, reasonings, some of the most brilliant natural minds in the world that look at us as though we're idiots for believing in God, speculate such things as this. Stephen Hawking says, if we know all the workings of the universe, we have the mind of God. It's Stephen Hawking's words and the theories of Einstein and the work up here on Mount Wilson by Hubble and the scientific background that preceded once the church released its grip, the discovery that the chemical makeup of the stars sending out the light with a spectrum you can analyze for the colors of the spectrum, the chemical makeup of those stars and elements we see out there, the Doppler effect and its contribution to science, that the spectrum moves to the red side because the light waves are being stretched out. And if something's going away from us, you had the red shift because it's moving and stretching away from us. But when it's coming toward us, like crunching a string together, you have the blue shift, the opposite, that lets you know on the spectrum whether it's coming towards you or going away from you. And certain kinds of stars that are very few within a galaxy can be measured, and we know the distance to them measured in relation to another. And the astounding realization that just tore the whole religious world apart, that the universe is expanding. And what's amazing is that from anywhere in the universe you look from Mars, you look from Jupiter, you look from the brightest star in the Milky Way, you look anywhere from the sun, every direction is expanding. And what's more amazing, because they're able to measure it, frequency of light waves, all the very complicated things, science is brilliant. That's why they've got and captured the mind of the world against the morons of the Middle Ages church that even frowned upon the movement of manuscripts into the West after the fall of Constantinople, because they said that the translators like Erasmus were corrupting the Word of God by introducing heathen tongue like Greek and Hebrew. Now, when asteroid orifices like that have controlled the mind of the world for 1,500 years, you can understand brilliant scientists fleeing from such oppression. But they've gone to the other extreme. Now they've measured and they can tell the universe is expanding. And what's amazing is that the furthest reaches now, multiplied billions of miles, light years out, the furthest reaches are moving faster than the closer ones. Like there's a faster rate of movement in the distant section as it expands outward. And I used the illustration the other day like a raisin in a ball of dough, a bunch of raisins. As the dough expands, each raisin has the sensation that all the other raisins are going away from him. Now, the fact that it's going faster out there than close by doesn't mean that it's going faster than it ever went. Relative again. It's faster in relationship to the more close by galaxies. But in overall expansion, there are those that say it's slowing down. So it introduces the ultimate multi-billion dollar years down the road, not dollars, years down the road of will it expand to the point of exploding? And since the overall expansion, though faster at the edge, like a balloon blowing up but gets faster out at the edge, overall slowdown, make it peak out and start to implode. So, and the red stretch in distance going away, it's cooling. And way out there, at some point, is the universe going to freeze or blow up and fry or run out of steam and come back down and compress? Vain reasonings of darkened minds who can't credit a mastermind who put it together. And once the gravity idea came on the scene, Einstein postulated what he later called his greatest mistake, a cosmological constant that somehow had repulsive effect that would keep it from ever collapsing. And then once all these figures were put together, particularly Hubble up here on Mount Wilson, it became apparent you could measure speed and distance, and therefore, speed, acceleration, and distance, you could turn it around and go back, because that furthest piece out there somewhere going the fastest started out somewhere. And all this explosion is sending the momentum and sending us going every direction in space. Go backwards. Retrace the billions of years back. Now, Hubble went back about 2 million years, and his subsequent students and followers refined the measurements to around 14, 15 billion years ago. This all started. All these raisins started going, and the dough started rising at a big bang. Some super explosion. And because it starts with a singularity by that theory, that means there had to be compacted mass and energy that let loose, and you can't go past that first millisecond where it started. And the church, a French, or rather an Italian priest, Amateur, he began to propose this is the answer, and the church gets back in the act. Church and science have been divorced. But all of a sudden, the work of Hubble and Einstein's theory that the constant, unknown, theoretical, repulsive force would keep it from contracting back, he comes all the way to L.A. to confront Einstein with what he called his theory of the primordial atom. That this Big Bang had to start somewhere, and that leaves room for God to spit on it and incinerate it. And he convinced Einstein that his cosmological constant was wrong. He calls it the biggest mistake of his life. And that a Big Bang started somewhere, and all science ran to embrace it. And then along comes Hawking and his study of black holes and the singularity of these masses compressed until they capture light. And the proof that in these black holes you have a beginning point. But he didn't want to accept it. Don't make room for God. So his latest theories in these books is to enter into new dimensions now and project an imaginary time zone that has the universe incapable of having a beginning and therefore doesn't need a creator. And space is curved and shoot a laser, it'll go around, come back and hit you back to the head eventually. And that what we call the cosmos is like the beginning is the North Pole and the so-called endpoint is the South Pole, and the Earth is a finite sphere, but there's no boundaries on it. You can walk from the North Pole to the South Pole, assuming you've got big boots and can warm up in the process, and walk right past the South Pole and come around on the other side. There's no end to it. Now, this imaginary time thing that Hawking is talking about is almost as bad as trying to figure out not absolute time. And look what they conclude. They conclude, I'll give you some of their conclusions. What's Hawking say? In the end of his brief history of time, Stephen concludes, well, I got a brief history of time. I have to listen to him say what he said. If we discover a complete theory, then we shall all, philosophers, scientists, and just ordinary people, take part in a discussion of the question why it is that we in the universe exist. If we find the answer to that, it is the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we would know the mind of God. Because it's all there. They ask Einstein. They ask Einstein, you believe in God? Well, let me read you what he said. He expressed it in a telegram sent to a Jewish newspaper in 1929, the year I was born. I believe in Spinoza's God, who reveals himself in the harmony of all that exists, but not in a God who concerns himself with the fate and action of men. Spinoza was a pantheist, or really a panpsych. He was into panpsychism, that the universe, the cosmos of Sagan, is all that there is and all that there ever was, all that there ever will be, but he added that it's a thinking universe. It does the thinking. Now these are the substitutes that these brilliant minds pass to us in place of faith, which is just not allowed in this tunnel. I'm bringing it to a close, so hang tight with me. All right. Everything. Space is now not absolute. I can understand that a little bit. Time is not absolute. I'm beginning to understand that. Matter is not absolute because we have the uncertainty principle of something down there that we can't locate and pin down to its feet at the same time. So nothing is really certain about all that, that they're telling us is the certainty we put in the place of God. Now, this Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen experiment that the universe is non-local and you spin one particle one way, opposite particle spins the other way, it relegates space, time, and matter to provisional status. It's just provisional. Well, that's what the Bible said years ago. Heaven and earth will pass away. That's provisional status. But my word will never pass away. If we were to look out upon the world through a window with, say, 9 panes of glass set in place to lattice work, we'd see the outdoors as divided by lattice work. But of course, that's not the landscape we're looking at all. Something like that pertains here. The moment of truth in the EPR experiment opens a rift in the cloud of unknowing through which physicists catch sight of another world, or at least another reality. Again, I'll let Henry Stapp say it. Everything we now know about nature is in accord with the idea that the fundamental processes of nature lies outside space-time, but generates events that can be located in space-time. Physicists have now found out that what runs the show, runs the spatial, temporal, material universe, lies outside the show. But your kids aren't being told that in school. Still, in establishing the existence of something, if only a non-further characterized... This is getting heavy. You still with me?
Yes, sir.
Non-characterized X is saying something's there. More and more scientists are finding that if the mathematical ratios in nature had the slightest bit different, life could not have evolved. Force of gravity, the tiniest bit stronger, all stars would be blue giants. Slight weaker, all would be red dwarfs. And on, I read that the other day. And the chances, I quoted from him, the chances of evolution producing an enzyme. It's like a tornado hitting a junkyard and coming out with a 747 piloted by 2 pilots. People that understand the chances of some of these things happening, which mathematically is here named as 1 in 10 with 40 zeros behind it. And there's no longer those on the cutting edge in science that laugh when a fellow scientist, Dale Kohler, writes, "We've been scraping away at physical reality all these centuries. Now the layer of the remaining little that we don't understand is so thin that God's face is staring right out at us." Well, that's science of physics. I mean, they push it to the limits, and they still don't know what's out there. They push it to the limits, and they can't even decide whether it's going to expand infinitely, expand and blow up, run out of steam and contract, and what happens when it gets back to the beginning again. They can't agree on anything. They just don't know. Science is fine. Explore this world. But admit you don't know. Don't build a platform that says your theories are the equivalent of science. Well, let's go to another one. The second question. How did life get here? Well, that's biology. I shall not be dealing with molecular biology here. DNA and the 3 billion chemical letters of which human genes are made. The technological possibilities for bioengineering, for good and for ill, are giant. But the metaphysical implications are modest. So I want to go straight for the prize, he says, Charles Darwin. Even today, it's virtually impossible for conscientious biologists to admit that the evidence for evolution is extraordinarily thin. We simply have little tangible proof that one species evolves into another. As Darwin recognized, the fossil record is the weakest source of support. And there is a book that I recommend you get for your kids. Icons of Evolution, Science or Myth, Jonathan Wells. Houston Smith references him with a summary. He said, during my years as a physical science undergraduate, biology graduate student at the University of California, Berkeley, I believed almost everything I read in my textbooks. I knew that the books contained a few misprints and minor factual errors, but I was skeptical of philosophical claims that went beyond the evidence. As I was finishing my PhD in cell and developmental biology, I noticed that all my textbooks dealing with evolutionary biology contained a blatant misrepresentation. Drawings of vertebrate embryos showing similarities that were supposed to be evidence for descent from a common ancestor. But as an embryologist, I knew the drawings were false. And he proceeds then to show the so-called icons of evolutionary theory that are handed down, starting with a laboratory flask containing a simulation of Earth's primitive atmosphere in which electric sparks produce the chemical building blocks of living cells. He proves that was a fraud, the Miller-Urey experiment. It did not duplicate the original Earth atmosphere. Just as simple as that, and yet it sold with as much passion as the medieval priest sold their ignorance about religion. He then goes to that wonderful little chart, Haeckel's embryos, that's in about every textbook, shows how the embryos of all these different fish, frogs, turtles, chickens, and human beings all look the same. The only problem is, he fabricated many of the drawings. Now a fact that many scientists know. They now know. Haeckel produced many drawings of vertebrate embryos to illustrate his biogenetic law. They show vertebrate embryos looking very much alike at an early stage. In fact, the embryos look too much alike. According to historian Jane Oppenheimer, Haeckel's hand as an artist altered what he saw with what should have been the eye of a more accurate beholder. Whether or not Haeckel was guilty of fraud, that is deliberate deception, there's no doubt his drawings misrepresent vertebrate embryos. Just plain false, but still in the textbooks your kids will read. Another one is the so-called moss. Peppered moss resting on tree trunks. That's in every textbook. Trying to show how they adapted so they could survive by landing on these tree trunks by changing their colors through evolution. The only problem is, science has proven now, peppered moss don't go to those trees. That is, now you can't exist in the current scientific world if you are against Darwinism. It's presented as the answer to how we became. Started with a fraud. I have a full festival where Darwin stole the ideas from a man who did it first in the Amazon jungle and was sick with fever in the East Indies, and Darwin beat him to the Royal Society. He started with a fraud. Well, let's go to the next one. What's the third question? How do we human beings get here? Well, that takes us into cognitive psychology. And the place to concentrate is that mystery between mind and brain. With all the millions, I mean, the day he wrote these words, an alumni couple announced they were giving MIT $65 million for brain research. And mental materialism returned. The idea of science that our minds can be explained by the brain, the nervous system. Problems easily described. We have consciousness and we have bodies. In this context, the brain is part of the body. Neither of which can be converted into the other. Equally obvious is the two-way relationship that exists between them. If my mind orders my right forefinger to type the letter J, it obeys. From the other side, if my brain grows tired, part of the body, from obeying such orders for several hours, I feel tired. Problem is, how can neuron firings in my brain give rise to things as different from them as my thoughts and feelings are, and vice versa? Science can't explain it. And he quotes, now, shortcut it, he quotes out of Colin McCain's, or Colin McGinn's book, Mysterious Flame, The Problem of Brain-Mind Connection. And he uses a story, an excerpt from the science fiction writer Terry Bison, an alien explorer, just returned from an Earth visit. And he's reporting to his commander. He found one of us. They're made out of meat. The commander, meat? There's no doubt about it. We picked several from different parts of the planet, took them aboard our recon vessels, and probed them all the way through. They're completely meat. That's impossible. What about the radio signals, the messages to the stars? They use the radio waves to talk, but the signals don't come from them. The signals come from machines. Well, so who made the machines? That's what we want to contact. They made the machines. That's what I'm trying to tell you. Meat made the machines. That's ridiculous. How can meat make a machine? You're asking me to believe in sentient meat? Meat that has sense? I'm not asking you, I'm telling you. These creatures are the only sentient race in the sector and they're made out of meat. Well, maybe they're like orphali, you know, carbon-based intelligence that goes through a meat stage. Nope. They're born meat and they die meat. You know, like, they're born meat and they die meat. We studied them for several of their lifespans, which didn't take too long. You have any idea of the lifespan of meat? Spare me. Okay, maybe they're only part meat. You know, like the white lie. A meathead with an electron plasma brain inside. Nope. We thought of that, since they do have meatheads like the wet lie. But I told you, we probed them. They're meat all the way through. No brain? Oh, there's a brain all right. It's just that the brain is made out of meat. So, what does the thinking? You're not understanding, are you? The brain does the thinking, the meat. Thinking meat? You're asking me to believe in thinking meat? Yes. thinking meat, conscious meat, loving meat, dreaming meat. The meat is the whole deal. These Mysterians, as they call the new name to this, having gotten us where they want us, which is to see that science has made no progress at all in allaying the absurdity of the concept that squishy gray matter in our heads, thinking meat, can cause mental life, whereas similar appearing liver meat cannot, they then unloaded on us their surprise. We may be stuck with this problem for as long as we human beings are around to ponder it. For what do we think we are, they ask, omniscient? Every day we discover anew that the world is more strange, more complicated, and more mysterious than we had suspected. This leads Mysterians to speculate that the mind-body problem is just too big for us to get our finite minds around, including the universe, macro and micro, and these thinking meatheads, which is what Paul called them a long time ago. Matthias, self-deceived, with the light of intuition withdrawn because of God's wrath, unable to have this wonderful gift of their intelligence and their brains, make room, just make a little room for a creator, however they want to define him. Recognize that this mysterium that has thwarted the best mind for these thousands of years, at least they've come, as in Stephen Hawking, to a beginning, and the beginning point, the other piece of paper is there for you to see, as I have said. You come out of the tunnel with the beginning of faith, as Hebrews 11 describes it. This is the starting point of faith. We recognize by faith that all these things that we see, by faith, were made from nothing. The Amener, as we've called him, the faithful God who knows when he says something, it will happen. Spoke and not a thing became everything. And faith begins with that word before what we see became. And what we see, and now, what you see is static on radio, is what one scientist asked for, a fossil of the first beginning, the 2 or 3 degrees above absolute zero. Every part of the universe has got the remnant of that first happening. Everywhere they go, they uncover more needing to be explained than what they've explained. Unwilling to accept what Hebrews 11 says is the starting point of that which pleases God. A creator spoke it into being. A creator harnessed it, guides it, and can interfere as he will, and heaven and earth may pass away, but that word and the one who uttered it will never pass away. And Christianity is, as Paul so adequately said, from faith to faith in that word. Thank God the light has not been drawn away from you and leaving you with a perverse brain and a mind incapable of bringing things together. That's the hope that the gospel brings. I'm still in the tunnel next Sunday as I move on, but that's my message for today. Oftentimes, always hate running out of time just when I get to the point where I can pull the knot together. But if you're here next Sunday, we'll take us further into the conclusions of how to get out of this tunnel. This generation has been falsely captured. And under the masquerade of science, empty, vain reasonings and projections of a mind from which the sensibility of God's gift of insight is withdrawn will pursue the most ridiculous ideas as long as it does not include God anywhere in the dimension. Now, if you were God in His place, I think you'd be fed up too. It's time for science not to move out of the scene. It's time for science to recognize that the floor of this life is broader than the narrow little tunnel that they have built, and begin to show some respect for other avenues of truth, and at least the possibility that a God is out there in spite of His being diminished by throwbacks to medieval morons that try to simplify this earth into some 4,000 product because of what Bishop Usher did with some chronologies years ago. There's no conflict between true science and the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Then a vast gulf of time. And the proper reading of the next verse, the earth became a waste and a desolation. There's no conflict with science. God didn't say. He could. He could have created the earth with fossils in it. But God's Word doesn't say that the Bible's only, this earth's only 4,000 or 6,000 years old. There ought to be no conflict between the pursuit of God and the God hunters and the God believers and those who seek to understand this universe alongside those who see in the broadened understanding of this universe and can sing in their spirit, "How great thou art! Who made the mountains?" as Elvis Presley used to sing. "Who made the sea?" Somebody bigger than you and I. Now I want the song as we close today, "I'm so glad Jesus lifted me." Are you glad? You're glad the light has not been withdrawn. Now make your reservations for next Sunday. Be here. Voices of Faith, be faithful this week. A tour of the Bibles will follow at the close of the service. Let the ushers do their work, and then you're free to go. And good day to you all.